waves goodbye, waits for his wife, and back they go to the car. Governor Connally standing in the car with a big 10-gallon hat on. The party now is leaving Dallas Love Field. And, of course, as we say, thousands will be on hand for that motorcade now, which will be downtown Dallas.
President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
Were shot down by an unknown assailant wielding a possible .30 caliber rifle. The motorcade suddenly aborted as the President and Governor Connally pitched to the floor of their limousine covered with blood.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Attention all squad. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a .30 caliber rifle. No further description at this time or information. 1245 KKB 360.
I've not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in Missouri. I'm just a patsy.
You let out by Captain Fritz. There is a president. There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot.
Mr. Oswald died at 1:07 our time, in the operating room of the gunshot wound which he had received.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Over the last several episodes, we've been diving deep into attorney, author, and early JFK assassination researcher Mark Lane's 1967 documentary, Rush to Judgment. It is a critical piece of work on the assassination, and unfairly gets overlooked because it's not some flashy, easy on the eyes or ears dramatization. But like I said at the end of the podcast last week, these are interviews with ordinary people that got caught up in an extraordinary event. And not by their own choosing, by the way. These are not people looking to make a buck off their story or become famous. These were boots-on-the-ground, first-hand accounts from people who were there in Dealey Plaza the day of the assassination, the moment of the president's murder. Today, we will hear from one of the witnesses closest to the president at the time he was hit, and someone who took what has become a very famous photo. But as you will hear from her testimony to Mark Lane, a more important picture that she may have taken that day was taken from her, and no one has seen it since. Why? We will also hear from a witness that may shed some light on Jack Ruby's relationship with the Dallas PD at the time of the assassination. We will hear from Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade and Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry just flat out lie about knowing Jack Ruby and play off Ruby's relationship with the Dallas Police Department. We will also hear the fascinating testimony from a witness that saw the shooting with Officer J.D. Tippett. Her story is a showstopper. Thanks you here today and a whole lot more are covered in my newly released book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. It's available and on sale now at Amazon.com, or you can purchase it from my website. That's www.endofinnocencejfk.com. Please also let me know your thoughts on the book or the podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. I really appreciate all the hundreds of emails I've received about the podcast or the book. And I promise, I will respond to each and every email I get. Now, on to this week's episode.
In preparing its evidence, the commission suppressed one photograph, mutilated another, cropped a third, and made a mystery of a fourth.
Mary Moorman photographed President Kennedy approximately 1/6 of a second after President Kennedy was struck in the head as Zapruder framed 313. At the time the photo was taken, Moorman was standing behind and to the left of President Kennedy, about 15 feet from the presidential limousine. Moorman said in a TV interview that immediately after the assassination, there were three or four shots close together, that the shots were still being fired after the fatal headshot, and that she thought she was in the line of fire.
And I took the picture. It so happened my picture, when I took it, was at the same instant that the president was hit. And that does show in my picture.
Did you realize what had happened when you heard the shot?
No, I didn't. There was, three or four real close together. And it was, must have been the first one that shot him, because that's when that was the time I took the picture. And during that time, after I took the picture, and the shots were still being fired, I decided I better get on the ground.
You did lie down?
I did. I was no more than 15 foot from the car and in line of fire, evidently.
Did Mrs. Kennedy scream on the first shot?
I don't know about the first shot, but she did scream. She says, "My God, he's been hit," or "he's been shot."
Now, the picture you took, I understand the FBI has it now.
Yes, that's right.
The federal police did have it on November 22nd, but it was never published or referred to by the commission. The agent who took it from Mrs. Moorman described it, quote, "Mrs. Moorman had taken a picture of the lead motorcycle officer. In the background of this picture was a picture of the book depository building and the window where the gunman sat when doing the shooting. A picture of the window at the time of the shooting, why wasn't it published?"
Mary Moorman took 5 Polaroid photographs the day of the assassination. Polaroid photograph number 1 shows her standing by her car in Dealey Plaza. Polaroid photograph number 2 is her friend Jean Hill, which was standing by the car in Dealey Plaza. Polaroid photograph number 3 is of motorcycle police officer McBride, who is leading the motorcade. A lower level of the school book depository is visible in the picture. Polaroid photograph number 4, which was taken towards the Texas School Book Depository and may have showed the 6th floor window, was confiscated by the FBI and has never been published. Did it show Oswald in the window, or perhaps someone else? Moorman's Polaroid photograph number 5 is now known as Badge Man Photo. Moorman's photograph captured the fatal headshot that killed President Kennedy. When she took it, approximately 1/6 of a second after President Kennedy was struck in the head, as Zapruder framed 313, Moorman was standing behind and to the left of the president, about 15 feet from the limousine. whatever was captured in the background of Mormon's photo has been a matter of contentious debate. On the grassy knoll, some have claimed to identify as many as 4 different human figures, while others dismiss these images as either trees or shadows. Most often, one figure has been dubbed the Badge Man, as it seems to resemble a uniformed police officer wearing a badge. Others claim to see Gordon Arnold, a man who claimed to have filmed the assassination from that area. My good friend and fellow researcher Jack White believed to his dying day that the Mormon photo captured one of the assassins of the president firing from the grassy knoll. We may never know. A big question for years has been, what was Jack Ruby's relationship with the Dallas police at the time of the assassination? Nancy Hamilton, who worked for Ruby at the time of the assassination, may answer this question in her interview with Mark Lane.
The suspect's name is Jack Rubenstein, I believe. He goes by the name of Jack Ruby.
Yeah. Do you know Ruby before this?
No, sir. Saw him in this very same room Friday night when we had the defendant up here. If some of you will recall, he asked a question from out here in the audience, or answered a question. He's standing right back here, and I didn't know who he was. I thought he was a member of the press, and he told me as we walked out of here that he was a nightclub operator here.
We have not been able to find anyone of our men who saw and recognized Ruby in the at the time of this transfer.
The thing that I saw, I was waiting at the armored car to ride with the suspect to the county jail. I knew that they would bring him out. They had cleared the way, and then I heard the shot. I didn't see the gun. I just saw the struggle that ensued. I immediately ran from the armored car down the ramp and tried to help subdue the prisoner that had shot Oswald.
Now, do I believe that you recognize this man after the capture?
Yes, sir.
Did I understand you to say that if you had seen him before, you would have ejected him?
Yes, sir.
Well, now, as Oswald was escorted out, were the policemen to either side of him? Weren't there any in front of him?
Yes.
How did the man get by the policeman in front?
The only thing I know is that someone said he jumped.
This is Detective Jim Lavelle, who was this morning handcuffed to Oswald and was bringing him out to the car to be transferred to a county jail. Could you tell us what happened?
Now, you were handcuffed to him?
I was handcuffed to him and also had a hold of the waistband of his trousers. I saw this man come from the crowd, and at the time he emerged from this crowd of people, he was not more than 6 or 7 feet from me.
Did you see the gun in his hand as he came?
I saw the gun in his hand as he emerged from the crowd. But being such a short distance from me, I had no time to say anything. My partner on the other side, Mr. Graves, grabbed Jack's hand with the gun in such a manner that he couldn't fire it anymore.
Did you recognize him when he came through?
Yes, I have known Jack Ruby for a number of years, and I recognized him just as soon as he emerged from the crowd.
We are in the office of Napoleon J. Daniels, a real estate broker in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Daniels, have you been associated with the Dallas Police Force?
I was for 7 years.
In what capacity?
As a patrolman.
Where were you on November 24th, 1963?
Well, I was going down to inspect the assassination site around 11 o'clock, I guess, and I noticed Officer Vaughn standing on the Main Street ramp of the City Hall at the basement. And I stopped to go back to talk to him, and I asked him what his purpose was there. And he told me he was keeping anybody from entering the basement because they fixed to transfer Oswald.
How long did you remain in front of the Main Street ramp with Officer Vaughn?
About 20 minutes, I guess.
Did you remain there until you heard a shot?
I did.
From 11 o'clock until 11:20, did anyone enter the basement through the Main Street ramp?
There's one man about a couple of minutes before Oswald was shot.
Could you describe that man?
Yes, he was a white man, weighed about 175, and had on a blue suit, about 5'9".
What was the color of his hair?
It's brownish, and he's bald in the top.
Was there anything else distinctive about the gentleman?
He had his right hand in his right coat pocket, and something seemed to be protruding from it.
What was your impression when you saw him enter the basement with his hand in his pocket?
My first impression was that he had a gun in his pocket, And then I didn't think too much about it because Officer Vaughn didn't challenge him. He just let him go on down in it.
Did Vaughn indicate any recognition or knowledge of who the person was when the man passed by him?
Well, I just assumed he did because he didn't try to stop him. I assumed he knew who he was.
Did Vaughn allow anyone else to enter the basement other than that one man?
No.
How long after that man entered the basement did you hear a shot?
About time enough, I guess, for him to walk down in and get settled.
Chief Curry, would you comment on the presence of Jack Ruby in the basement of City Hall while Lee Harvey Oswald was being transferred? How did he get there?
Well, of course, it's been pretty well established by this time that he came in the ramp entrance, on the Main Street entrance. And the officer who was guarding this door had stepped away to permit a vehicle to come out. It wasn't necessary that he do this, but he had stepped across the sidewalk to assist a vehicle coming out of the basement. And that's when Ruby came into the basement. And this was less than 2 minutes before Oswald was brought down.
Where was Officer Vaughn standing when this man entered past him?
He stood right in the center of the entrance to the basement there.
And what was his responsibility or obligation that day, do you know?
To not let anyone go down in there for them. I know.
Have you any idea why he allowed this man to enter past him?
No, I don't know, other than just he knew who he was or something. That's what I thought at the time. He had to know who he was.
Did Officer Vaughn look at the man who walked past him?
He looked in this direction, yes.
We're at the Lewiston Raceway in Lewiston, Maine, with Mrs. Nancy Hamilton, owner of the Hamilton Stables. Mrs. Hamilton, did you testify as a witness before the Warren Commission?
Yes, I did. On June 2nd, 1964, I have been a freelance investigator for various police departments, district attorney's offices, such as the Sacramento District Attorney's Office, Suffolk County, Massachusetts District Attorney's Office, Boston Police Department, and various private detectives.
And before that, were you employed by Jack Ruby?
Yes, I was. This was in 1961 in Dallas at his club, The Carousel, and I was bartender, waitress, and rather the manager there.
How did you get that job?
I had gone into Dallas not knowing anyone, and of course the first place I went was the police department, and they were very kind and got me the job there.
They got you the job at Jack Ruby's?
Yes, they did.
Did they know Ruby?
Personally, oh, yes, very well. Vouched for him. Wonderful person. Great man. Well known by the Dallas Police Department.
What were your duties there?
Well, general bar duties, such as setting up the liquor, getting the bar ready for the evening trade, waiting tables if he was short-handed. Otherwise, I'd be behind the bar serving the drinks.
Did you ever serve drinks to Dallas police officers?
Oh, yes. In fact, the Dallas police officers were the special boys, shall we say. We even had private stock for them.
Private stock?
Oh, yes. They wouldn't, bar liquor wasn't for them. We had names such as Hague and Hague or Black Label. The very, very high-priced drinks on the house, of course, you'd never charge. And that was a gross oversight if you ever charged a Dallas police officer or any official of the city of Dallas or Tarrant County.
Well, other than the Dallas police officers, what officials did frequent the Ruby's establishment?
Oh, such as your district attorney, which would be Mr. Wade.
Did you receive any specific instructions from Jack Ruby about serving drinks for the Dallas police officers?
Yes. In fact, Jack told me point blank. He said, Nancy, if you ever, he said, intentionally or unintentionally, charge a Dallas police officer, he said, you might as well go look for another job. He said, don't offend them, cater to them, talk with them, even if you ignore the other customers. Bend over backwards to be nice to them.
Did Ruby perform any other favors for the Dallas police officers?
Well, yeah, well, favors, well, if we call them favors, I suppose so. He provided girls, gambling, and booze.
How many Dallas police officers would you estimate Jack Ruby knew on a personal basis?
At least half and probably two-thirds.
There were almost 1,200 police officers in Dallas in 1963. Would you say Ruby knew 600 of them?
Oh, easily.
A great deal has been written about the relationship of the Dallas Police Department with Jack Ruby. We have 1,200 men in our department, and we had each man to submit a report regarding his knowledge or acquaintance with Jack Ruby. Less than 50 men even knew Jack Ruby.
You see, Jack Ruby was a man who wanted to be noticed, wanted to be known. And he used to frequent the Dallas Police Department. And he used to brag, I can get this fixed for you, I can get that fixed for you.
Did the Dallas Police Department or District Attorney's Office ever do any favors for Jack Ruby?
Several that I could probably name, such as serving drinks a little late.
I mean, Ruby was permitted to serve drinks after hours.
He did, and no one ever interfered. And, of course, it was common knowledge that he ran girls and gambling, and I've never seen him any kind of a pickup on it.
Did you serve mixed drinks to police officers?
Yes.
Is it against the law in Dallas to serve mixed drinks?
Oh, yes, definitely, except in a private club.
This, of course, was not a private club.
No, open club.
So that every time you served a drink to a police officer, it was a violation of the law?
Yes, and I'd say I probably broke the law a few hundred times in doing so.
And of course, the police were witnesses.
Well, up to a point there was witnesses. After that, I guess they probably didn't care.
The man who lit the fire in me back in 1989 to dive down the rabbit hole of the JFK assassination was Penn Jones Jr. He had some very interesting things to say in his interview with Lane. Keep in mind, this interview was done in 1967.
We are at the office of Penn Jones Jr. in Midlothian, Texas, 25 miles from the Dallas courthouse. For the past 2 years, he alone in the Dallas area has conducted an independent investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy.
Well, I love President Kennedy very much. I was one of the few weekly newspapers that covered the Ruby trial. And my actual investigating did not begin until I started reading the Warren Report and realized that something was very, very much amiss in reading that report. I really believe that the only way you can believe the Warren Report is to not read it.
Have you found it difficult to uncover the facts this time?
Yes, it's very difficult. Witnesses are reluctant. Some of them have gone into hiding, or at least cannot be found by me. And in many cases, the police have actually told, or in some cases, some witnesses say, federal authorities have told them not to talk about the assassination. The witnesses are frightened. Some of them went into hiding. I'm sure that I spent at least 1 month searching for Earlene Roberts. And I don't know of any person, any newsman, or any investigator that talked to Earlene Roberts after she testified before the Warren Commission. And her testimony was quite startling.
Mrs. Roberts told Commission counsel of a rather mysterious incident which occurred just after Oswald entered the rooming house on November 22nd. At approximately 1 p.m., she said, a police car drove up to the house at 1026 North Beckley and parked outside. Questioned by Commission Counsel, where was it parked? It was parked in front of the house. Did this police car stop directly in front of your house? Yes, it stopped directly in front of my house. Where was Oswald when this happened? In his room. Were there two uniformed policemen in the car? Oh, yes. And one of the officers sounded the horn? Just kind of a tit-tit, twice. The commission did not satisfactorily explain why a police car stopped in front of Oswald's dwelling or why the policeman sounded the horn twice and then drove away just before he came out.
Now, of course, she is dead, and she's not the only one. There are at least 8 persons now dead, either from murder or at least strange death, who were closely related to Jack Ruby or Lee Harvey Oswald.
Can you give us one instance of a witness who died a strange death?
Well, let's take the case of Betty Mooney McDonald, one of Jack Ruby's strippers. A fellow named Warren Reynolds saw a man running from the scene of the Tippit slaying. Shortly thereafter, Reynolds was shot through the head. Now, before Reynolds was shot, he could not identify the man running from the scene as Oswald. Then he was shot through the head, and a fellow named Garner was arrested. Then McDonald was the alibi for Garner. She said Garner could not have shot Reynolds because he was with me at the time. 2 days after her alibi, Betty Mooney McDonald was arrested for fighting with a roommate, although the roommate was not arrested. McDonald was put in jail that night, and an hour later she was found hanged in her cell. And of course, the Dallas police said she hung herself.
Did Reynolds finally testify before the commission?
After Reynolds recovered from his wound, he testified and was able to identify Oswald.
Mr. Reynolds, where are you employed?
At the Giant Reynolds Motor Company.
And were you working there on November 22nd, 1963?
Yes, sir.
How close is the used car lot which you work to the scene of the Tippit killing?
One block.
Were you there at about 1 o'clock on the 22nd?
Yes, sir.
And then what happened? What did you see? What did you hear?
We were listening to the radio about the assassination, and we heard these shots, and we ran out on this porch, and we saw this gunman running up the street, and I followed him for a block until I lost him. And then I was going back to the used car lot, and this policeman stopped me and asked me what had happened. And I told him that I had seen this man with a gun, and I had followed him, and I lost him. So he took the description and my name, and after that, I went on back to the used car lot.
Were you questioned by agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation or the United States Secret Service during November 1963?
No, I sure wasn't.
Were you questioned by FBI agents or Secret Service agents during December 1963?
No, sir.
Were you questioned by FBI agents or Secret Service agents during January 64?
Yes, sir, I was.
When was that, sir?
That was on January the 21st. Two agents come out and they talked to me and asked me what I had seen. And I told them, and they showed me three pictures.
You were questioned by agents of the FBI on January 21st, 64. Then what happened?
2 days after that, as I was closing up the used car lot one night, when I went downstairs to turn off the lights, some gunman was hidden down there and he shot me. He shot me through the glasses.
Mr. Reynolds, who knew about your questioning by the FBI between the time that you were actually questioned by them and the time that you were shot 2 days later?
Just friends and, of course, my family.
The commission concluded on page 663 of its report that it was wild speculation for anyone to think that there might have been a connection between the fact that you were shot in January and the fact that you observed the gunman flee from the Tippit scene. What is your comment, sir?
If they would catch the man and prove that he did do it, we could figure out from there whether he was connected or not. And until then, I don't believe anybody is smart enough to say whether it is connection or not.
That's one of the examples, and there are many others. Bill Hunter was shot through the heart in the police station out in Long Beach, California. Jim Cody on the Times Herald was killed by a karate chop to the throat in his apartment in Dallas. And the man that was the most likely suspect was not even indicted for the murder. The death of Tom Howard is a very strange one. They said he died of an apparent heart attack. There was no autopsy. But I know personally that Tom Howard was acting very strangely 3 days before he died. I and other people who saw him felt like that he was very frightened. 3 days later, he was dead. Now, he was the man who saw Jack Ruby first after the killing of Oswald.
Well, whether these deaths are related to the assassination or not, does the fact that witnesses have died in this fashion tend to make it more difficult to secure statements from those witnesses who have survived?
Certainly, there is very little evidence, firsthand evidence, left. With the erasing of the lives of Tippit and Oswald and these other people who had firsthand conversations with either Ruby or Oswald, that has made the gathering of evidence very difficult. And the continued threats on these people who still have evidence makes them hesitant to talk. And it makes anyone trying to do investigative work very, very difficult.
Do you know of any witnesses, commission witnesses, who were threatened before they testified before the commission?
Mrs. Clemens was one. She witnessed the killing of Tippett.
Aquilla Clemons lived on the north side of 10th Street in Dallas. On November 22, 1963, Clemons was sitting on her front porch of her house when she saw Officer J.D. Tippett killed. What she tells Mark Lane she saw is fascinating.
Mrs. Clemons, where were you on November 22, 1963?
I was working for Miss Smotherman, 32718, just where? Down the block from where Tippett was killed.
Did you know Officer Tippett?
Yes, I saw him pretty many times.
And did you hear the shots?
Yes, I heard the shots.
And what did you do?
I ran out into the street and looked down the street, and I ran back down the street where he was lying, and I looked at him.
Now, when you heard the shots and you went out of the house, did you see a man with a gun?
Yes, I did.
What was he doing?
Oh, he was reloading it.
And how would you describe that man?
Well, he's kind of chunky. He's kind of heavy. He wasn't a very big man.
Was he tall or short?
He was kind of short guy.
Short and heavy?
Yes.
And was there any other man there?
Yes, there was one on the other side of the street. All I know, he told him to go.
Mrs. Clemons, the man who had the gun, did he make any motion at all to the other man across the street?
No more, I told him to go.
Well, he waved his hand,
yes,
and said, go on.
Gone.
And then what happened with the man with the gun?
He unloaded and reloaded.
And what did the other man do?
Man kept going straight down the street.
And then did they go in opposite directions?
Yes, they were. They weren't together. They went this way from each other. The one down the shooting went this way. Other went straight down past street that way.
What was the man who did not do the shooting, but the man who went in the other direction from the man with the gun? What was he wearing, if you remember?
Well, I can remember he looked like light khakis and a white shirt.
And was he tall or short?
He was tall.
And was he heavy or thin?
He was thin.
But the one who had the gun, seconds after Tippett was shot, he was short.
Yes, he was short and kind of heavy.
Now, did you testify before the Warren Commission about this case?
I haven't said anything to anyone.
Did anyone come to see you after the murder of Officer Tippett?
Yes, he was a man who came. I don't know what he was. He came to my house and talked to me. But I don't know what he looked like, a policeman to me.
He did. Did he have a gun?
Yes, he wore a gun.
Mrs. Clemons, how long after Tippett was shot did this man with a gun come to visit you?
About two days. It was about 2 days. Said that I might get hurt. Someone might hurt me if I would talk.
About what you saw?
What I saw. He just told me to be the best if I didn't say anything because I might
get hurt. The documentary ends with some words from Penn Jones Jr. that rings even more true today than it did back in 1963. Quote, "Something is very wrong in the land," end quote. We'll see you next week.
Love to see a computer faced with the problem of coming up with probabilities of the assassination taking place the way it did, with all of these strange incidents that took place before and are continuing to take place after the assassination. I think all of us who love this country should be alerted that something is wrong in the land.